agenda for today, so let's try to continue, possibly finish off the sugya of Hamavazbez. The sugya has taken a little while, but it's understandable because it really is a shas sugya. It's a sugya that kind of expands really every mitzvah, almost by definition. It goes over the width and breadth of Kol Torah Kula. Has to do with how we interact with much of our basic chiyuvim, so it's not so surprising that it covers a lot of territory. But we've seen a lot, and what I'd like to do now is to kind of take it home. So let's try to highlight the important points and see how they come together. So first, we've seen that we have two passages in our Gemara, one on Zayin Samaches, and one on Daf Nun, where we're told about a concept of a chomesh. It's not 100% clear from the Gemara whether it is a takan exclusively, is it a limitation, is it an aspiration? It sounds a little bit more from Yerushalmi in certain statements of the Rambam that it's an aspiration. We spoke about that a little bit. It's interesting to note in that context that if you want to figure out, is this a limit, or is it something we should strive for? So what would the din be without the Takana Susha? What would the default be? So the Chassam Sofer has a tshuva in Yoredei in Siman Shin Chav Tes, where he assumes that the din min haTorah is that anyone who has any money at all, so if he can survive from one day to the next, everything left he has to give to tzedakah. And essentially, the Takana Susha came to limit that. So Midin Torah, you have to give away pretty much everything, just leave yourself survival minimum, but not anything else. And Chazal came and said, no, you have to hold on to more than that, and made this institution of Chomesh. The Shevet HaLevi, Rav Osner, has a tshuva where he writes, he thinks that this is very surprising, because we know the Mishnah says in Pei, the Mishnah that we recite every morning, that Eilu Dvarim She'ein Lahem Shir, that staka is inherently without a shear. It's always a question what that means. Is that a minimal shear, a maximal shear, or is it both? But it seems like when we talk about staka, that min haTorah, at least, we don't really have a limitation in one direction or the other. So if that's the case, it doesn't seem like you have to say you have to give away all of your money without takana susha. So it's a discussion whether or not this is true. But it helps us to frame the question. Again, is the idea that this was a limitation put onto our existing reality, or is this an aspiration encouraging us to give more? So perhaps the tshuva of some sofer is relevant. We also discussed the question of, is this a notion that is specifically about staka and not about mitzvos? Or is it specifically about mitzvos and not about staka? Or is it about both? And there were strong svaras to say every possibility. There were reasons to focus it specifically on staka. As we noted, maybe primarily because staka is inherently inconsistent to impoverish yourself for the mitzvah of staka. There's a logical flaw there. Or we could say specifically about mitzvos, because mitzvos are between you and God, so God could say, all right, I don't have to impose on you that much. I can give you credit for your intent, but starving human beings can't. Or it's also possible, and maybe likely, that it's about both. It's about mitzvos in general, and staka included among those mitzvos. The Birkas Avram, popular yeshiva shefer in the Masechtas, so the Birkas Avram and Masechtas Ksubis, so he assumes that the takana was by staka, but the concept exists more as a guideline when it comes to mitzvos. They only had to make a takana for the purposes of staka, because staka, to borrow the phrase from a minute ago, ein la shir, essentially is infinite. You could always find enough recipients of staka that you'd have no limit to how much you could give. So therefore, there was a need to actually say we have to draw the line somewhere. When it comes to mitzvos, so mitzvos don't always present themselves in such a demanding way. Sometimes they do and sometimes they don't. So it's not necessarily the case that one is going to, by definition, have to spend everything he has on a mitzvah. It's more of an unusual situation. So it wasn't necessarily the case that we had to put a takana into place and say people have to be told not to go crazy spending on mitzvos. That's, in general, more under control, but maybe stuck is where you needed specifically a mitzvah. But when we talked about the question of limitation on mitzvos, so we presented the question, so why should there be a limitation on mitzvos? Now, we said that when it comes to tzedakah, so we understand it a little bit more, it doesn't make sense to impoverish yourself in order to help poverty. But when it comes to mitzvos, it's not clear what the issue is. It could be that the same logic applies, that maybe also we have some notion you shouldn't impoverish yourself at all, even for other things that are not about fighting poverty. Or it could be that this idea of being impoverished and being forced to go from door to door and ask for help, that is a indication of tsar, that represents a certain level of suffering. And this is a general idea telling you that there's a limit to how much you're obligated to do in mitzvot. You're not obligated to anguish yourself. This is the way of Shmuel Rizovsky and the Sefer Zecher and Shmuel. Shmuel Rizovsky was one of the most popular Megiddei Shir in the world a generation ago in Panevish. So we have many volumes of the Shiurei, Chidushei Reb Shmuel, different versions of his Shiurim and Masechtas. But there's one sefer called Zecher and Shmuel, which has a lot of his thoughts in the form of essays and mamarim on many different topics. So in the Zecher and Shmuel, he has an idea there that this is about tzar, that halacha is basically telling us that there's a limit to how much you're obligated to do in terms of mitzvos. And that's what we're being taught here, that you don't have to undergo the tsar of bringing yourself close to poverty. So Rav Yitzchok Zilberstein, as his wont, he has fascinating discussions of practical halachic topics on the daf. So if you look in the Chashukei Chemed to Ksubis Daf Nun, so he has a discussion about whether or not one is obligated to undergo tsar in order to perform a mitzvah. He has the question there in a very technical sense. He's talking about somebody whose parents are unfortunately kind of at war with each other emotionally, and whether there's an obligation for one child who's being pulled into it to get involved. So he says, well, Havas Shalom ben Adam l'chaveru was a mitzvah saseh, and because it's a source of great anguish for him to get involved, so there's room to say he's not obligated. Clearly it's a very technical way to look at a child's relationship to his parents. It's an unusual kind of example, but the point is very valuable nonetheless, that maybe the whole idea of an exemption of chomesh is about tsar, and therefore we could also transfer that to non-monetary cases where there is tsar involved. So how do you quantify the tsar? So presumably you have to say that if it's the kind of tsar that you give up more than a fifth of your money to avoid, so then we can put a dollar sum on it, and we can say that that's the whole point, that you don't have to undergo such suffering for mitzvos. And even if it's not about suffering money, it's not about spending money, but it's about suffering in a way that we could quantify through your budget, it'll have the same story. Hi.
Things like that have something of an opinion as far as whether or not a fifth is actually set in stone. But it was all based on tsar. For one person, it could be 80% of his money, and for one person, it could be 10%
of different tolerance levels.
Because of some, depending on the amount of discretionary income somebody has.
Right, so it's interesting how to assess that, because you'd say, so clearly there is a subjective element to tsar, so should we assess it then based on your 20% regardless of who you are, because maybe that's a good way to figure out what's an unacceptable level of tsar, and maybe we should say that even a very wealthy person who is going to, say a person has $10 million, so now he's obligated to undergo tsar up until the point where he would pay $2 million to avoid it. It's a pretty high level of tsar. Presumably that's a higher level of tsar than the average person in a fifth of his money kind of position. So it's an interesting question to consider. It would probably distort things in the other direction. Right? But now we're imposing a higher level of tsar. Because even a very wealthy person, let's say somebody has $10 million, so to say you have to undergo tsar up until the point where you'd give $2 million to avoid it, that's probably pretty intense tsar. Because even the very wealthy would find that quite a threshold problem. So it's interesting that the subjectivity goes in that direction, maybe. Now you could also say, well, maybe let's not really quantify it based on money, but let's say that people have different standards of what's considered tsar, and therefore something comparable, however you want to assess it, to the 20% limit for tsar. But it's also interesting because your subjective attitude also defines how the tsar impacts you. So it is a little bit hard to measure. So it's an interesting question to speculate how exactly you're going to quantify it. He assumes it's this give up one-fifth of your money standard to avoid the tsar, but it would probably shift from person to person and would get into serious subjectivity. All of this question, for sure, the question that Zilberstein is talking about, for sure gets into serious subjectivity. It happens to be a particularly complex example. There's no question that a lot of these issues are going to require a very careful assessment of what exactly we're talking about.
Is this different than Kavod HaBrios?
So that's also interesting. So Kavod HaBrios, we could say that it all corresponds to that. We could say that Tsar is based on Kavod HaBrios. Kavod HaBrios usually in the Gemara seems to correlate to embarrassment as a form of Tsar. So whether it has to have its own definition is a good question. You could say that it correlates to Kavod HaBrios, which would also make things very neat, because Kavod HaBrios, again, we have the same kinds of distinctions, so we could apply it like that. But it's probably room to distinguish between the two if you wanted to. So there's another interesting question about Tsar, but before getting to it, so just to mention another issue. If we distinguish between assays and los assays, so we discussed last week that that distinction could be based on a few things. It could be based on severity, the assumption that los assays are more severe than assays. And why would you say that? Probably because of punishment. Or it could be based on passive behavior versus active behavior. If you're actively doing something wrong, however we classify it, that's a chil Hashem, that's an act of aggression. While if you're just leaving something out, if you're just being passive, whether we call that an assay or a los assay, that's more acceptable. So one major nafkamina of that, which I don't think we discussed, is what about an exceptional mitzvah assay like bris milah or Korban Pesach, which we don't get involved with so much nowadays. So what about bris milah? So let's say a bris milah is going to cost you a whole fortune in order to do it bismillah. Well, you could easily imagine that. Let's say you live in some remote area and you have a bris on a 3-day antif, and the only way the mole is going to fly out there is going to cost you a fortune. You're going to have to put him up in a hotel, and you're going to have to do whatever crazy things in order to get him there for the 3-day antif. So you could imagine having the bris on a specific day could theoretically be insanely expensive. So what standard do you use for a bris milah? On the one hand, it's a mitzvah saseh. On the other hand, it has an onesh. So if it's based on severity, and severity is correlated to onesh, then bris milah should really be treated as a los assay. But if it's based on just leaving things out, a sin of omission rather than commission, then bris milah, no matter how severe it is still passive.
Right? Is it possible that's totally on the focus around Rambam and Ravid about whether bris milah you violated only at the end of your life if you didn't have one versus every second you don't have one?
So I think it's very possible. I'll tell you why it's possible. Because the question is, when does the onesh kick in, right? So in the case that we're talking about, so we're not talking about never having a bris milah, we're talking about not having it on the 8th day. So if we're saying that the severity comes from the onesh, so then it becomes important to know, when does the onesh kick in? So does the onesh kick in immediately, or does the onesh only kick in if you die without a bris milah? In which case we could say, listen, pushing it off till the next day, that may not be the full fulfillment of the mitzvah min haTorah. So maybe that doesn't incur the onesh. So I think to that extent, it may be totally on that. But it's also interesting, you find this discussion in a few places also, just to give you other examples of how bris milah might be treated as a los assay because of the onesh. First of all, the Gemara has a pasuk to tell us that women are pater from bris milah, meaning that they're pater from giving a bris milah to their sons. The obligation to give a bris milah to your son is only on the father and not on the mother. So Tosfos asks, in Megillah, a similar question in Pesachim, that why do we need a pasuk for this? It's mitzvah saseh shazvan gram anyway. So women should be patur anyway from giving a bris to their sons. So some explain that maybe bris milah is treated like a lo saseh, because even though it's a mitzvah saseh, but the onesh shows you it belongs in another category, so women are normally obligated in lo saseh, so you need a special pasuk to tell you this is an exception. Or there's also a question, why is it that we have a bris milah on Shabbos when we don't blow a shofar on Shabbos or take a lulav on Shabbos? Min haTorah, you're required to do all three. Min haTorah, you're required to blow a shofar on Shabbos if that's Rosh Hashanah, to take a lulav on Shabbos, and to have a bris on Shabbos if that's the 8th day. But midrabanan, we're afraid of carrying. So we say, don't blow shofar and don't take a lulav. But the bris milah, we still do. So that's a question in Tosfos, a number of Rishonim ask, and there are many different answers. But we could say the same thing, that we don't blow shofar on Shabbos because yesh koach lakar davar menatar v'shev al taseh, because the rabbis have the power to passively contradict the Torah to protect other mitzvos. So not blowing shofar, taking a lulav, that's passive. But not doing a bris milah, maybe that's not called passive because there's an onesh, so therefore if it's about severity, maybe bris milah is treated differently. So keeping that question in mind, there is a tshuva in the Avnei Nezer. The Avnei Nezer in Simen Shin Chof Aleph in Yeridaya has a tshuva which combines the previous 2 points. So what about delaying a bris milah because of, not because of great expense, but because of tzar? He has a case where you have a baby who has some type of a condition with his legs, which could be fixed with surgery immediately. That if right after birth, they're going to have a surgery for the baby, so then the situation will be fixed. Otherwise, he will permanently have an issue with his leg. He won't be able to use it, or whatever. It'll be some serious issue, some serious side that he will be stuck with his leg for the rest of his life. So he could have the surgery that will correct it, but if he has the surgery, then he has to delay the bris milah. He won't be able to have the bris milah on time because the surgery won't allow for both. But if he waits till after the 8th day, then the surgery won't be possible anymore. So what do you think? So are you allowed to push off the bris milah for the surgery? So, first of all, one question is, do we treat bris milah like an essay or a close essay? So here, he's assuming the Avnei Nezer that we treat it like an essay. So it's the question of the 1/5 standard. And there he writes that the 1/5 standard means tzar also. So since it's a tremendous tzar for this baby to be stuck with this lifetime condition because he doesn't have the surgery on time, so that qualifies as tzar, and therefore that's a justification to take off the bris milah. Just like we would say for sure that if it was a life-saving surgery, we'd push off the bris milah for that. So too, for the tzar, that's also a justification. That's what the Avnei Nezer writes. We also, I think, mentioned the question of whether or how do we address the issue of when somebody comes and asks you for an appeal, let's say if somebody needs to have a surgery for life-saving purposes, then the question is, how come you don't have to sell your house and give them everything in order to enable that? Isn't it a problem of lo samar al damriecha? You could say lo samar al damriecha is a lo sase, and therefore you should be obligated to give up all your money in order not to violate that. So this was discussed in many svarim. I think I remember reading in the art school biography of Reb Chaim Ozer, for some reason that in the biography they talk about the discussion of this question, but Reb Chaim Ozer's successor in Vilna was Reb Chenech Egesh, who wrote the Sefer Marcheshes. So in the Marcheshes he talks about this question also, I think it was Simen Mem Gimel, and he assumes a couple of possible answers. Among them, that maybe Lo Samar Al Damriecha, when they're asking for money, is essentially like a mitzvah staka, and therefore it follows those rules. And he also notes in that sense that Alosa said you have to spend all your money, that would only work, that would only apply if it is a mitzvah ben adam l'makom. Kind of the opposite of what we saw earlier. But a mitzvah ben adam l'chaveiro, so then we always have the standard of shalcha kodem l'shalchavero, the inherent logic of staka that you have to take care of yourself first. So to say that you should completely bankrupt yourself in order to save someone else is not logical. You have to assume that the chiyuv flows directly from staka. And you'll recall last week we also discussed that the losa says that the Torah has in Parshas Re'eh for staka. We could also assume, like many do, that does not make it into a mitzvah lo saseh, that any time the Torah has an asay and a lo saseh, and they're clearly a match set, the Torah is clearly saying, do this and don't not do this, that the rule is the rule of the asay. And so to here, one could understand the lo samar al damriecha, as it is in the staka context, as a reinforcement of the obligation of staka, and therefore would follow those rules of a fifth rather than all of your money. And then you'd have to also factor it in with other stucco priorities before figuring out exactly what that means. Okay, so there is also a major discussion, which the Bekur Yaakov, we've been mentioning, I think, every day for the past week in different contexts. That's the Rebbe of Ettlinger and Hopeless Lulav. And the Pricharish asks, what about a mitzvah derabanan? So does a mitzvah derabanan have the one-fifth rule? Does it have the give-up-all-of-your-money rule? How exactly do we regulate it? So why would you say it should be a give-up-all-your-money? Why should that be the rule for the Rabbanan?
Say Chazet L'Rabbanan.
Well, that might be. You might say, okay, we find that Chazal sometimes reinforced the mitzvot, but there's another reason to say it. The assumption that maybe the Rabbanan, almost counterintuitively, are more chamer than a mitzvah saseh d'oraisa, because there is a lo saseh that addresses them. What's that?
Lo
saser. The Pasuk in Parsha Shoftim, according to the Rambam, a major dispute he has with the Rambam writes that the Pasuk that tells us do not deviate from that which the rabbinic authority tells you, lo saser min hadavar, that is the source for new rabbinic enactments. So the question has always come up, the Rambam raised and others raised, that if that's true, how are we ever made ill by the Rabbanans? Why don't we say you're violating an Isser Daraisa? So there are many approaches to that question. It's not really our topic for today. But some think that might be relevant to this issue. Should we say that, well, it shouldn't be any worse than mitzvah saseh Daraisa? Or should we say that, no, it should be treated like a lo saseh Daraisa? Or what if it's a lo saseh Drabbanan? Is a lo saseh Drabbanan treated like a lo saseh or an asay? So there's a lot of literature about this. Quite a lot to discuss. Just mention, I don't remember if I put it on the Maamar Komos last week, the Tosfos and Sanhedrin, the Daf Chavav, did I put that on?
Yeah,
so that's just a good Shemitah source, so it's relevant. It's also, I think, we probably talked about it last semester because it comes up a lot in the Het Mechira debate. The question of, is a Gemara, Mesachah Sanhedrin, and Daf Chavav, that's next year's Mesachah, so joins together today's Sugya with next year's Mesachah with Shemitah, so it's a triple synergy. Sorry?
It's still synergy.
It's still, yeah, that's Sanhedrin's fault. Gemara and Sanhedrin. So the Gemara talks about there was a tax that was levied on the people that was very crushing, and they were told to go plant and to go plow in Shvi'ez. So Tosfos asks, how could you do that? It's Mr. Daraisa. How could you violate Mr. Daraisa for this basic sustenance? So Tosfos has two answers. That first of all, maybe nowadays it's Drabbanan, that's how we assume today. Most Poskim assume that Shemitah is Drabbanan. Remember we talked about this in the Het to Mechira discussion at some length. Or you could also say that it was so crushing that it was essentially Pikuach Nefesh. The situation was so dire that it was basically a Pikuach Nefesh situation. So the Bekur Yaakov and others assume that maybe that's the Machlokas. 2 days in Tosfos are basically addressing the question of, do we have a standard of having to give up all your money for a lo saseh midrabanan? That the first answer is saying, no, we don't, that since Shemitah is drabanan, that's why it was justified to do this for economic reasons. And the second answer is apparently assuming that that wouldn't be enough. Even if it's drabanan, that wouldn't justify such activity during Shemitah, and the only reason it was allowed is because it was essentially Pikuach Nefesh. Perhaps that's the Machlokas. In any event, the Maritz Chayis, in his commentary from Sefer Shulman and Afghan Tess and Midbeis, writes what seems to be the general attitude that we have nowadays, that we assume that when it comes to Dinam Drabbanan, you're not expected to enter into a Hefzid Merubah. Sometimes it's a local concept by whichever din d'rabbanan that we're talking about, and there's sometimes room to say that Chazal were not gozer in a specific case. But for the most part, that's usually the assumption that you're not expected to enter into a tremendous loss for din d'rabbanan, although there is some machlokas about it. Now, this also correlates to what Arya was bringing up a few minutes ago. You know, the question of, is this an issue of Kavod Abrios, that if we want to say that the issue is Tsar, and maybe Tsar is the same thing as Kavod Abrios, or maybe Kavod Abrios is the explanation one way or another, so then presumably we could follow the Kollelin for Kavod Abrios. So by Kavod Abrios, what do we find? You don't have to necessarily perform mitzvah saseh, and you can suspend dinim derabanan. So then we could say that the tzar of having to become bankrupt applies to those who follow also. You don't have to perform a mitzvah saseh, and you also have leniencies by derabanan. So if we really want to say it's all based on kavod abrios, so then there seems to be room to work from that perspective as well. Okay, so if we say that the Rabbanans don't require us to spend so much of our money, so then we have the question, which we discussed a little bit last semester, and I think touched upon a little bit last week. What about the Rambam statements when it comes to Pirsumi Yisr, which we'll spend a minute on now also, because it's in Yom HaDiyoma for Purim, so we'll just expand on this for a moment. So the Rambam writes, and the Shulchan Aruch Paskins like this as well, in Hilchos Chanukah, that the mitzvah of Chanukah candles is Chavivi Ad Ma'ov. It's a very precious mitzvah, and therefore you should go to great lengths in order to fulfill it. Even if that means Shol Al Apsachim U'Mochers Ksuso. Even if it means you have to knock on the doors and ask for help, or sell your clothes. So everybody asks, isn't this against the din? They're here for a mitzvah d'oraisa, even if it's a mitzvah overes, like a lulav, you're not obligated to spend more than a thick. And yet, when it comes to Chanukah candles, which are a din d'rabbanan, so there we're being told you have to go all out, you have to sell your clothes, you have to do whatever it takes. What happened? So the Magid Mishnah gives you an answer which isn't really a full answer. It just recategorizes the question. The Magid Mishnah says that there is a category called Pirsumei Nisa, that if you have a mitzvah that is about publicizing a miracle, so that has a different standard to it, and you have to go begging. How do we know that? Because it's a Mishnah. The Mishnah in the beginning of the 10th parak of Pesachim, where the Mishnah says that regarding Dalet Kosos, afilu ani halokeach minatamchui lo yifchas lo mi Dalet Kosos. Even if you're taking from the soup kitchen in order to support yourself, you still should also ask for 4 cups of wine. And therefore, that's the standard. So that, again, doesn't really answer the question, it just reshifts it. It says that, okay, when it comes to pursuing Nisa mitzvos, like Dalet Kosos or Chanukah candles, there you have to go begging. There's a lot of discussion about the Magid Mishnah. The Magid Mishnah says it's kind of a kal v'chomer from Dalet Kosos to Chanukah candles. A lot of discussion why he thinks it's a kal v'chomer. Maybe it's the same thing, but why is it more? Also, maybe you could say that the Mishnah is not telling anybody they have to go begging. The Mishnah is saying that regarding the public tamche, as we've been talking about, the public kupa, so if somebody comes and they want food for Pesach, so when you allocate how much to give them, so it's your obligation to give them also for Dalet Kosos. But it doesn't necessarily mean that they have to go begging and that they're in trouble if they don't. So there's a lot of debate about whether or not the source provides the whole basis for the Rambam's Pesach. But in any event, that's what the Rambam and the Shulchan Aruch both say, that one goes begging for Chanukah candles. There are also those who say it doesn't mean you have to, it means you can. Normally would say that it's not recommended, but here this mitzvah is so chaviv, we'd say that you should go begging. In any event, it seems to be an exception. It seems to be something that differs from the standard that we have by, let's say, tefillin or lulav, a mitzvah min ha-Torah, even a mitzvah overis min ha-Torah, you're not obligated more than a fifth. And yet, when it comes to Chanukah candles, so you see that that seems to be the rule, that one should go to great lengths. So one approach, Rav Shechter often quotes from Rav Soloveitchik, that he thinks it has to do with the nature of Pirsumei Nisa. And this is also especially relevant as we approach Purim, and unfortunately there are threats on the horizon from that same part of the world, from Persia, and we're very concerned about what that portends. So we're very much in this mindset that the idea of Pirsumei Nisa is that we want to make a statement that we received miracles in the past, we'd like some more miracles in the future, we'd like maybe even in that part of the world the same miracles to happen again. So if that's the case, that essentially it's a kind of a tefillah. You're basically saying that you're asking for a miracle. So if that's the case, says Rav Soloveitchik, it's a little bit incongruous to say that we want HaKadosh Baruch Hu to go outside of his teva, outside of his budget, so to speak, that he normally rules the world al pi derech hateva, based on the laws of nature, and now we want him to go beyond that. So it's a little bit incongruous for us to say, in order to make that point, we have allotted exactly 19.9% of our budget, not 1 cent over. It's a little bit of a inconsistent message that we're asking for something above and beyond, and we're not willing to go above and beyond. So within that perspective, we have to say essentially that the one-fifth limit is a patur, but it's possible for us to go beyond that if that's what we're inclined to do. And we're being told that for a mitzvah like Ner Chanukah, if we want to really get the message in a consistent way, so then we should go above and beyond. But there's another approach as well, and that is the approach of the Avnei Mezer, I think we mentioned before, that the idea of the Ptur Chomesh by mitzvos is a Ptur Ones, that we're essentially off the hook because you can't afford it. If you can't afford it, then you're exempt. And as we've noted, maybe that only works between man and God. God can say, I know your intent, so I credit you with that. But between man and man, it doesn't work. Human beings can't read your mind. So Persumei Nisa is essentially a mitzvah ben adam l'makom, which is really something you do for God, but it requires communication to other people. The whole point is you have to transmit the message to others. So it's not going to work. If you're not actually doing it, it's just not going to happen. You can't say that if you're not going to light Hanukkah candles because you can't afford it, so somebody will walk past your house and say, well, there's no Hanukkah candles here, but probably he wants to put Hanukkah candles, but he couldn't afford it, so I'll tell myself about the matter. So that's not going to work. So therefore, this requires us to not use the rule of Chomesh, if that's true. So just in honor of the Yonah Dioma, to apply that to Purim, even though Purim, we don't really have expenses as much, let's say in terms of the Persumei Nisa. The Persumei Nisa of Purim is really about Kriyas HaMegillah. So that generally is not so expensive in the average sense. If they let you into shul, if they don't make you pay membership just to come in to hear Kriyas HaMegillah. So it's generally not such an expensive proposition. But it could explain something else. There is a Gemara, Maseches Megillah, and Dav Gimel. But the Gemara has a statement there, Mevatlin Talmud Torah, Mishum Mikra Megillah, and Mevatlin Avoda, Mishum Mikra Megillah. That because of the reading of the Megillah, so we neglect, or we negate, so to speak, the Avoda space on Mikdash. So the Rishonim try to figure out, what does that mean? We neglect the Avoda space on Mikdash. Could it possibly mean that you only have time for one? You only have time either to do the Karbanos or to do the Mikra Megillah, and still you'll choose Mikra Megillah? So some Rishonim say, no, it can't be. Mikra Megillah is a Drabanan. And Avodas Beis HaMikdash is a Daraisa. How could it be that the Daraisa is going to give way to the Drabanan? It must mean that's not what it is. It must be that we're talking about you'll do the Mikra Megillah first, and you'll do the Avoda afterwards. You'll do them both. It just means that you're going to push it off till the second. While some Rishonim, minority of the Rishonim, say, yeah, it does mean that. It means that Mikra Megillah is going to take priority. If you can only do one, you'll do Mikra Megillah rather than doing the Avodas Beis HaMikdash. Again, because of Persumei Nisa. So Persumei Nisa, still Drabanan. How does that make it more important than the Avodas Beis HaMikdash? So we could say, based on the Avnei Mezer, the same idea. You could say that, yes, it's true that the Avodas HaKarbanos are more important, but that's Ben Adam L'Makom. So God can say, I know that you want to bring Karbanos, but there's no time, so I'll credit you as if they are brought. But Mikra Megillah, that's about Persumei Nisa. So that has to actually happen, and that has to therefore take priority. Which is interesting in general, we prioritize things, so it's not always because they're more important. Sometimes it's because of importance, and sometimes there are other reasons to prioritize things. If you look at the time management literature, so you find the distinction made between things that are important and things that are urgent, and things that are important and urgent, and things that are not important or urgent. So there are things that are important that are not urgent, like, let's say, Talmud Torah and maintaining your health. It's the most important thing in the world, but it doesn't present itself as an emergency today. While a ringing telephone could be urgent but not important. It's not necessarily an important call, but it's urgent because if you don't answer it now, it's not going to be ringing an hour from now. So sometimes you prioritize something because of urgency rather than importance. So it could be that, yes, the avodas hakarbanos are more important, that's a din min haTorah. But the urgency is with Mikra Megillah, because that there's no other way to deal with. The Kodesh Baruch Hu can credit you with your decisions for the more important avodas hakarbanos. But Mikra Megillah has to take priority because it doesn't have another avenue and has to actually happen. So that same approach, just to bring it into our specific inyan of Yom here. The Paris Yosef HaChadosh quotes in one place that the whole question about Moshe Rabbeinu, when Moshe Rabbeinu was so upset that he wasn't allowed to go into Eretz Yisrael in the beginning of Parshas Veschana, and he davened again and again and again that he should be allowed to go in. So the Gemara in Masechet Sota and Daf Yudalet, the Gemara asks kind of a technical question. You know, on an emotional level, we could understand it. We could understand why he was so upset. But the Gemara assumes that there must be something else to it. So the Gemara asks, what was Moshe so upset about? That he couldn't get the Shwarma or the Ragalach of Eretz Yisrael? Was that the issue? The Gemara calls it Peiros, but I assume it means Shwarma and Ragalach. So is it that he couldn't get the food of Eretz Yisrael? That's what bothered him so much? So says the Gemara, no, it's not that. It's that the mitzvah Satzlius Baritz, he wanted to fulfill the Shemitah, he wanted to fulfill the mitzvahs that he couldn't do Chutz Laaretz, and that's why he was so upset. So as the Gemara says, so why does he have to be upset about that? He has the best doctor's note in the world. That here, Kodesh Baruch Hu himself is telling him, I'm sorry, you're not going in. So how can anyone hold him responsible? Onus Rachmana Patre. So he didn't have an obligation to do these mitzvahs because it was impossible. So some want to explain, based on the Avinezer, that for Moshe Rabbeinu, he felt that all of the mitzvahs of the Torah had like a Persume Nisa component to it, because it was his job to teach all the mitzvahs to the Jewish people, and therefore he had to actually perform them. Other people, mitzvahs could be Ben Adam L'Makom or Ben Adam L'Chaveiro, but for him, all of the mitzvahs had a Persume Nisa component to it, and that's why it had to actually happen. It's interesting because there's a Medrash which suggests that Moshe Rabbeinu could have gone into Eretz Yisrael, except that not as the leader of Klal Yisrael. But if he was willing to retire and become a Talmud of Yeshua, then he could go in. And he was only wanting to go in as the leader of Klal Yisrael. So according to this Vort, the Lumdus actually works. Right? That as a Yachid, it's okay, Onus Rachmana Patre, so he wasn't Mechuyu to do these mitzvahs. But his whole desire was because, as the leader, he felt he had to model them, and if that wasn't going to be possible, okay, that's what the whole issue was. So, in any event, so this is a possible exception to the idea of Bizbaz Yosu Mechomish, depending on how you understand it. There are a few other Gemaras which one could ask questions about, just to mention one, because I put it on the Makaros last week. So, for example, the Gemara in Maseches Kedushin about Chotes. So the Gemara asks, if a person, let's say, has to choose who liftos to beno liftos. Let's say somebody is himself a Bechor, and he was never subject to a pigeon aben, so he has that obligation now for himself as an adult. And he has a Bechor of his own, so he has a total of 5 slain to his name, and he has to either use them for his own pigeon aben or for his son's pigeon aben. So what takes priority? So the Achronim ask, what do you mean what takes priority? And neither of them takes priority. If all of his money is 5 shloim, and he has to give it all for one of the mitzvahs of Pidgin Aben, so it's the mitzvah Saseh. So there's no obligation to begin with. So it's more than a chomesh. How exactly do you have such a scenario? So Achronim have different ways of saying it, but it goes to the effect, one way or another, of saying that either it is a mitzvah that's about giving money, and therefore it's not subject to this limitation. Or, similarly, that essentially there's a shibud, that this money is already, so to speak, the property of the kahuna, and it's the father, or in this case, the man himself, it's his job to just give it over to the kahuna. So if the money already is meshubah to somebody else, so then maybe there's no p'tur of hamavazveis. Hamavazveis is only when you're spending money to do a mitzvah, not when the mitzvah itself is the handing over of the money. Right?
Isn't that, that's the machlokas in the Gemara, is whether it's kiksuva b'shtar damim.
Right.
So it's only, it really goes according to one opinion.
Maybe. But if so, that would still explain why it should be an exception. And similarly, some Achron discussed along similar lines, the question of by Piron Chov, which is the Sugya in Xubis, and Afpevav, the question of how do we look at the obligation to repay a debt? Do you look at it as essentially a mitzvah, that the money is yours and you have a mitzvah, like a year a day mitzvah to pay it back? Or the money essentially belongs to the creditor and you just have to hand it over to him? And that could also affect the question of why is it that there also we don't seem to find an exception of Chomesh, that if somebody has to give more than a fifth of his money, you don't have to pay in order to pay off his creditors. We don't find such an exception, so why not? Parenthetically, not for now, but there is quite a literature on the concept of bankruptcy. So bankruptcy is a concept that exists in secular law, that an individual can declare himself unable to pay back his loans and be absolved of having to do so. So there is quite a literature. Does that concept exist in halacha or not? Do they say that a person who is going to become completely wiped out by paying back his debts is on any level exempt? So there's quite a lot written about this. I think of Asher Weiss, who should have got this in one of the volumes of his Shuvah Simchas Asher, which correlates to this question of the obligation of Piron Chov and how that will interact with somebody who doesn't have enough money to do so. Okay, so one could spend many, many weeks talking about every topic that ties into this, but I think we've had a pretty good exposure to some of the major themes. So just to recap another point, is that there are clearly other exceptions, so we just mentioned a few specific mitzvah exceptions, but there are general exceptions to the tzedakah principle, so some of them the Chafetz Chaim lists in his Sefer Avos Chesed, some of them Achronim developed based on some of the contradictions we've seen in the Rambam and elsewhere. But among the exceptions that we see, so we see, let's say, for example, Kaimi Aniyim, that if there are very present Aniyim who are very clearly asking for your help, it could be that this transcends the limitation of Chomesh. If it's a Pikuach Nefesh situation, you can save somebody's life, all the more so. That could transcend limitation of Chomesh. If the person is an Asher Muflag, somebody who is not going to be hurt by spending much more than a Chomesh, so that's also an exception. You also find say, occasional exceptions. If there's a certain need right now that you'll be able to recover from later, maybe that could also justify more than a Chomesh. The post can also point out that if it's a Kapara, that if you feel like you're in real trouble, you've committed Averis that are really going to condemn you big time in the next world, and you can only attain a kapara as far as you assess it through your tzedakah donations, so then that's essentially won't be pikuach nefesh. So then that should also justify an exception to the rule. So we find many exceptions along these lines, and then there is the question, which if you saw today's Marmakomos, the question of what about if you yourself are no longer alive? So if you want to give your money while you're about to be no longer alive. If you want to give away a large portion of your money prior to dying, at the moment of dying, so is that subject to a limitation of Chomesh, or is it subject to a different limitation than any limitation? So that was a major debate. If you had a chance to see some of the Torahs today, so you'll see that our Gemara, which talks about it, there are significant different gersos in our Gemara as to what exactly such a limitation will be. Probably at least three different gersos. So maybe that we will leave for the beginning of tomorrow, and then we'll transition into other things. So just we'll recap what we spoke about today, and then we'll dive limcha. So we spoke about the question of this basic takana: is it a goal or is it a limitation? The Chacham Sofer's tshuva about what would have been Diman HaTorah without this: to give away all your money, or is that not the case? And Shir, we talked about the question of what is the reason and the application of the takana. Is it by mitzvos in general, or is it by tzedakah specifically? And Birkas Avram's point that by tzedakah you need a takana because it's infinite, mitzvos aren't infinite. We talked about whether, when it comes to mitzvahs, is the exclusion based on you shouldn't become impoverished, or is it based on tsar? And then if it's based on tsar, how would that apply to situations where they're not asking you for money, but they're asking you to anguish yourself? We talked about the distinction between los asays and asays. Is it about chumrah, or is it about behavior, and how that would affect mitzvahs like bris milah? We talked about some other areas of halacha where bris milah seems to be treated like a los asay, such as mitzvah seisha as mangrama, and chazal not being able to negate it. And then we talked about the tshuva of the Avnei Nezer that discusses if somebody would push off a bris in order to avoid the baby going through a tremendous tsar in his life, and he allows that to happen, assuming that that's the standard, and it's a mitzvah saseh that is treated that way. And then we talked also about the question of samar al damriyacha, why that doesn't seem to require you to spend all your money, just seemingly from the way things are carried out, and the possibility that it's treated like a ben adam machavero, and therefore we say shalcha kodom shalchavero, or maybe because essentially it is passive, various points along those lines. And then we talked about what should the rule be by a drabanan. Should we treat a drabanan even an asei drabanan? Should we treat it like a los asei drabanan? Maybe that gets into the whole machlokas, the Rambam and others, the two deis and Tosfos and Sanhedrin and Daf Chavav, why they allowed planting and plowing in Shemitah year, because of economic pressures. Either that was because Shemitah was drabanan, or because the pressures were so great that essentially it was bikurach nefesh. The Koryakov says these are the two starting of the issue, and the position of the Maris Chai is that we're always makel for hefsid when it comes to the Rabbanans, and we noted that if the whole thing is based on Kavod Abrios, so then it should follow Kavod Abrios rules, where again we will allow Rabbanans and will allow even Mitzvah Sasei Mahatorah to be skipped for this purpose. And then we talked about the apparent acceptance of the Tumah Nisa, that the Rambam says by Halakas Neiros seems to be based on a Mishnah in Pesachim, even though there's some debate whether or not it extends that far. And we talked about two basic approaches, either to say that Tumah Nisa is a type of tefillah that we want more miracles, and therefore only makes sense that we should extend ourselves even further, or is the idea that Tumah Nisa is treated like a ben adam l'chavero because you have to convey the message to someone else. And then we noted that could also explain when it comes to Megillah, we find some Rishonim say it takes priority even over a mitzvah d'oraisa like Avodah Sakrabanos, and that we could use the same explanation that Avodah Sakrabanos is between man and God, because Baruch Hu can be mochel, but when it comes to Pirsum Anisa, so it has to actually get across. And we noted that some say that's also pshat why Moshe Rabbeinu felt he had to get into Eretz Yisrael, because he was teaching all the mitzvahs, and therefore that has to be conveyed, and you can't rely on omens. And then we talked about some more specific examples of exceptions where the Gemara seems to say that you might have to spend all your money on pigeon aben. It's just a question of whether it's for yourself or for your son that takes priority. So why shouldn't we say chomesh there? So some suggest because it's viewed like a shibu, the mitzvah itself is about giving money, and that should be the reason to not put it in this category. We talked about how that would apply to Piron Chov, brief mention of bankruptcy in that context. And then we summarize some of the Chafetz Chaim's and others' exceptions to the Bizbuz Chomesh rule, such as Kaimi Aniyim, or Pikuach Nefesh, or Asher Muflag, or situation, occasional need. It also points out, by the way, Hafzach is Talmud Torah. I'm sure YU would want you very much to get that message. And that's an exception to the Chomesh rule, according to the Chafetz Chaim. And perhaps also, if you have to have a kapara, if you feel like you're otherwise going to lose your soul, so then that's Pikuach Nefesh for yourself. All of these are considered as exceptions. And then we left for tomorrow, so the question of our Gemara about what about for after death, and how does that relate to one's inheritors? So that God willing, we'll pick up with tomorrow and then transition into the rest of the series. Okay, Ashrei Yoshev Yosef.